Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. This evening, we have parrots, pigs, cows, dogs, and ultra-small particles made of RNA that may in fact be entities. A science menagerie of curiosities on Ask Dr. Dawn. We'll also spend some time discussing, drugs that make other diseases worse, what we call in medicine the comorbidity trap. More about that later in the program. So let's start with the pigs. It was very much in the news that in the last 6 months, we've had two major breakthroughs, if you will, with genetically altered pigs. You know, full-grown pigs has organs, you know, roughly the size of ours, so it was an obvious target. A pig kidney has been successfully transplanted into a human for the first time, and this is really a breakthrough for thousands of Americans who suffer kidney failure. In this particular case, surgeons at Mass General Hospital attached the kidney from a genetically modified pig in a four-hour operation last week. The patient, Richard Slayman, who's 62 years old, shows no signs so far of rejecting the organ. And just right away, before they even got him out of the recovery room, he was peeing. His new kidney had already started producing urine. This poor man had been on dialysis for 7 years, before receiving a donor kidney in 2018, but that organ failed last year, so he qualified for this experimental treatment. It's very, very hard to place animal organs in humans normally. Because of tissue rejection. This is, by definition, another species. It's way worse than a tissue mismatch in human transplantation. In the two cases of pig-to-heart transplants, those have been carried out in people who were very, very sick. So even though both patients died within a couple of months, their life was substantially extended. And in all three procedures that we've done so far, the pig's genes have been edited to, first of all, inactivate retroviruses that are present in pigs that we really don't want deciding that they can mutate and get started in humans. And also, some human genes were inserted into the kidney. And in the case of the heart, they took out the alpha-gal protein, which is something that many people can develop allergy to. And you might, if you get rashes and itching after eating meat, might want to get checked for antibodies to alpha-gal if that's something that's going on in your body. Anyway, getting back to the kidney, should this kidney continue to work well, this is two levels of breakthrough because it gives us a bridge to transplantation. It could tide people over for months or years until a matching human kidney becomes available. There are 90,000 Americans waiting for a kidney transplant. If you have not gotten a tissue match, if you have not put an organ donor checkbox on your driver's license, please do so. If somebody else can use your kidney when you can't use it anymore, you can think of this as just Craigslist, right? Craigslist free. Good kidney, still has some mileage on it, free to a good home. Why not do that for some stranger whose life you could save as essentially one of your last acts on the planet? Okay, so they really struck it rich, or rather struck, I can't say it's exactly gold, but they struck insulin, which is worth a lot of money. A unit of insulin weighs 0.034 milligrams. So a gram of insulin is worth a lot of doses. Now, in this case, the scientists were trying to produce a cow who would make insulin in its milk. There are 8.4 million Americans who rely on the hormone. So this could be, if we can basically grow it in cows, that would be pretty amazing. Researchers did the usual thing you do in these settings. They inserted a targeted segment of human DNA into a bovine embryo. And when the calf grew up, they couldn't get her pregnant. So that's with something in there. But they used artificial insemination. That didn't work. So they gave her fake hormones, basically prolactin, to trigger her body into producing milk. This is the same protein hormone that's produced by the pituitary gland in a woman after she gives birth. And they gave her that and got what they hoped would contain pro-insulin in her milk, a human precursor, a hormone precursor for insulin. Insulin basically is an active molecule, and you get two of them, one inverted and connected by a little thing called C-protein. And in humans, we make an enzyme that cleaves the C-protein. Cows do the same thing for their own insulin. But they weren't expecting it to come out in the milk. However, the cow basically did the processing herself, producing in her milk actual insulin and the C-protein residue. In fact, that just to get a little CSI on you, when we are looking at whether or not a person might be given insulin, basically by a criminal or by someone who wishes to cause their death, or sometimes people will even overdose themselves on insulin, you check the C-peptide. If their body is making absolutely no insulin, then you will be able to see you will not see any of the C-peptide. If, on the other hand, the person is making C-peptide and you find an enormous amount of insulin in there, that could imply that there's trouble afoot and that this has been given artificially. So enough of the forensics science. Let's get back to the cow. As I said, you could have a small herd of cows at the volumes of milk that a dairy cow produces. You could have about 100 head herd, and that would produce all the insulin needed for the entire United States. When you start thinking about that, you can see why this is a very interesting process. I also promised you parrots, and of course, anyone who's ever had a friend with a parrot or had one themselves know that they're very, very intelligent birds, and they get bored easily. So lately, people have been giving parrots iPads and having them play children's games. But, you know, the parrots, in order to, they tap with their beak, it doesn't really register, so they have to lick the screen. So researchers have gone out and designed a study to show how app designers could modify existing games for parrot use. Among other things, they taught 20 pet parrots to play a certain touch game using rewards. For most of the birds, that meant treats, but there was one bird who was not very food motivated, instead was most responsive to just cheering and praise. I like to call him the Generation Z bird. Anyway, the study found that birds tend to lick their targets rapidly and repeatedly rather than just pressing once, and that they use a lighter touch than a human. So now app designers are going to be designing parrot computer games to keep your parrot from getting bored. I love it. So I don't think I mentioned the poor bees in my discussion earlier of what we'd be talking about, but let's talk about bees learning complex tasks and tricks. A study done at London's Queen Mary University trained bumblebees to solve a two-step puzzle, teaching them to press a blue lever to release a lock and then a red lever to open a door leading to a reward of sugar water. So the bees figured it out. They got trained and they knew how to do it. They added more bees to the environment, and those newbies sat around, watched the bumblebees figure open the puzzle, and started doing it themselves. So this showed for the first time that insects can learn a multi-step process through just plain social interaction. So we know that chimpanzees can pass down knowledge, tool use for chimps, songs for whales. And this is the first instance of an animal learning socially a task that would be too complicated to come up on its own. A bee spends, it lives for about 8 weeks, and it couldn't possibly invent the two-lever technique in that amount of time. They liken it to the equivalent of a human stranded on a deserted island as a baby, inventing the atom bomb. Well, I did think that that was a group effort, but nevertheless, I find it fascinating that bees can learn so quickly. Well, another thing that isn't learned is the propensity that Labrador retrievers have to obesity. About one quarter of Labradors have a gene mutation that's associated with obesity in animals. This gene mutation is called Opia melanocortin, POMC. It actually makes the dogs feel hungrier and burn less energy. Well, that's a recipe for obesity if there ever was one. So researchers gathered in this study 36 adult Labradors, a mix of dogs with no mutation, one copy, or two copies. And then we need to get the Society for Cruelty to Animals. They were given a clear box with a perforated top so they could smell it and a sausage inside. And the dogs with the mutation were far more determined and persistent trying to break into that box and get the food than those without. A separate study looking at similar dogs with the same mutation found that those who had two copies of the POMC mutation burned 25% fewer calories at rest. So they were getting a sort of molecular starvation signal that basically led to overfeeding. So they will always be hungry because they always feel hungry, even if they really don't need more food. Keeping them occupied and distracted. I'll tell you, I wonder how much it costs to get swab the inside of the dog's cheek and send that off for DNA testing before I adopt a dog, because I definitely need one who, while I want to play ball sometimes, I definitely do need to sit at my desk and work as well. So a few more stories about the wonders of dogs. Let's talk about a new study showing that dogs may be able to sniff out an oncoming PTSD flashback. So we've known about seizures and sudden hypoglycemia, but recently dogs have found evidence that assisting dogs might be able to sniff out an oncoming PTSD flashback. They used the breath, the changes in the human's breath, to train the dogs. And we have in our breath and in our sweat a lot of volatile organic compounds, VOCs. These are natural VOCs that we're able to deal with. If you want an example of unnatural VOCs, go into the Costco tire store and inhale through your nose. You will be smelling cartloads of these VOCs, and they do create a target for our livers and our biotransformation enzymes. We can break them down, but it can also be overloaded. Getting back to the dogs, they, of course, have extremely acute senses of smells. And so they recruited 26 humans, and they were also taking part, these humans, in a study looking at people who'd experienced trauma. And some of these people met the diagnostic criteria for PTSD. Some of them did not. So we had the positives and the negatives, and they would wear a face mask that would, when they were recalling their trauma, they would wear this face mask, and that created the target sample for the dogs. And then they were also talking about their stress levels to make sure that they were really stressed. And then they recruited to pet dogs, and they found that they, out of 25 dogs, they found two who were really, really good at identifying stress in discriminating at a level of 90-degree accuracy between a stressed and a non-stressed sample. So this is just an interesting idea that maybe we can use dogs. So far we've had dogs that can sniff drugs. We've had dogs that can sniff out an impending seizure, hypoglycemia. We've also have dogs that can sniff out cancers of various types, particularly prostate cancer in the urine. So it's a matter of figuring out how to train them. But I can definitely imagine that for screening purposes, we may be employing dogs in medical labs before too much time goes by. What else have we got? We've got elephants, right? We've all marveled at the elephant's trunk. It uses it for drinking, to smelling. It can rip up trees. It can put out a 110 decibel blast. And trucks can also be used to suck up food, a skill that previously we would only seen with certain fish. But a researcher at the Zoo Atlanta, working with an elephant named Kelly. She's a 34-year-old African. And she has the ability to very gently pick things up with the, let's call it the upper and lower lip of the trunk. They are almost little tiny fingers. But if she's given something larger, like a tortilla chip, she'll actually pucker her trunk up and apply suction and suck the, use her nostrils to breathe in and suck the, she can create essentially suction, or she can inhale water at speeds of more than 490 feet per second. That's a pretty amazing speed. This suction thing is something they don't often use in the wild, but as researchers are exploring it, it just tells us that these animals are highly adapted for their environment and even adapted for environments that they don't currently live in. I mentioned the small entities formed of RNA. These are now being called obelisks, and this is from a preprint coming out of Stanford University. These are tiny bits of RNA. They are even smaller than viruses, and they're so small that they colonize the bacteria inside human guts and mouth. They transfer information, and they encode sequences that no one has ever seen before. So this is like a completely new thing that no one knows what it does, but now that they found it, they went looking for it. They went looking in a source that is readily available now, RNA analysis of human stool. So when you get your genotype or your GIFX or you get a stool test that uses genetic data, they're looking at something called 16S RNA of the bacteria. But there's a lot of other RNA, a lot of it from humans, a lot of it from, certain RNA viruses. And, of course, a lot of it RNA from the food that the person ate that didn't get completely broken down into its components. But hiding in that absolute haystack of RNA are these consistent little, I don't even know if I should call them critters. Let's call them entities. I like that. It has a sort of sci-fi feel. So they're found in 10% of gut and oral microbiota collected from 472 individuals. So basically, we've all got this in some of the bacteria in our body. We have no real idea of what they do. So stay tuned for more on that score. You can reach me at 831-900-5773, and someone just did. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I listened to you last week about a woman who had grooved nails, fingernails, I think it was, and she had, I can't remember the disease, it was lymph something or other.
She had a very, very, yes, she had had multiple episodes of basically a collapsed lung, and she'd had 10 collapsed lungs. And so when she was an emailer, and we had talked about it on her first show, and then she sent me a second email giving me her diagnosis. And at that point, I talked a little bit about the disease. The grooved nails were one of the findings, I believe. I don't have the paperwork on that.
My question has to do with, I've had maybe for the last 4 or 5 years, I'm 70, and the nails, my fingernails have developed like ruffles or grooves in them. And my doctor said it was arthritis, but my acupuncture said it's my liver. So do you have an idea?
Is it all of the fingers, including the thumbs?
Yes.
Okay. And do you do anything that could cause any kind of trauma? Are you a woodworker, gardener?
No, not at all. Nothing. No exposure to toxins or anything.
Well, I was thinking more about just physical trauma to the nails. I mean, people can create horizontal grooves. There are grooves that are parallel to the line of growth, and there are grooves
That's it.
Right. So if they're parallel to the line of growth, and they're in all of the fingers, that usually does come from arthritis. And
okay.
So the reason basically is that when you have distal arthritis, osteoarthritis of the hands, the bones get bumpy, and the nail bed itself is distorted by the rising up of the bone underneath. And so you just get a sort of corrugated extruder plate. Normally the nail plate is this very slightly curved two plates next to each other, and it squeezes the material that grows out of the matrix and forms it into a nice, slightly curved but mostly flat fingernail. And we have certain diseases, certain lung diseases, a bad COPD, for example, and that curve will get exaggerated, and so that's called clubbing of the nail. You'll see that sometime in long-term smokers. And we can see in, for example, iron deficiency, the blood isn't getting well to that area. The person is anemic, and you'll see spooning of the nail where it'll sort of dip in the middle. So there are quite a few indicators. In psoriasis, you'll see pitting of the nail. But in your case, I think your primary care doctor was correct that arthritis would be, assuming you have it, would be the most likely thing. The correlation with the liver is... While I do acupuncture, I will tell you that is a Chinese medicine thing, and I never completely disregard Chinese medicine stuff, because obviously not everybody with arthritis gets crinkly nails. So how come you could I would get liver, I would get my liver checked.
Well, I had tests, and my liver checked out fine. So.
Okay. And have you been checked for hepatitis C? Because you should be, and a lot of people in your age group have never been checked for that. So
no, I'll have to admit, haven't tried that one.
Yeah, it's just something that, you know, children of the 60s, okay, we got around. We did some stuff. And so the idea is that either you might have done some stuff, or somebody that you knew, or somebody that they knew, and I'm talking new in the biblical sense in this case, could have done some stuff, and that stuff might have carried virus into your body, and Hep C is a real stealth virus. So it's always, it's been, I think the thing is, anybody who is a boomer or a post-boomer should be checked for Hep C. And I forget what the most recent birthday is, but it's like born in the 80s or something before we start checking. So some news you can use now, which is, a lot of people out there listening may suffer from hypertension, or they may know someone who does. And so here's some information that you can use. New research suggests that boosting potassium is key for blood pressure control. Now, when I was in medical school and in my residency training, part of what you tell people for ulcers was you tell them to drink a lot of milk and eat a bland diet. And during my years of practice, that turned out to be absolutely wrong, because most ulcers are actually caused by a bacteria, and the way you treat it is antibiotics and Pepto-Bismol. So you don't treat it with a bland diet. There are, of course, the other cause of ulcers is taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which many, many people take on a daily basis. And I might add, those contribute to hypertension because they affect fluid balance in the kidneys. So if you're having a hard time getting your blood pressure down, you might want to switch away from that daily Advil or two that you're taking at night in order to sleep. So getting back to the potassium issue, I was taught that reducing salt intake was a big piece of controlling blood pressure. It turns out that salt sensitivity tends to distribute on fairly clear ethnic lines rather than being a universal. But our diet is clearly got too much salt in it, so it's not bad to reduce your salt, and it does help your kidneys last a lot longer. But where the real bang for the buck is in raising your potassium levels. Potassium intakes are really substantially lower than they probably should be. The current dietary guidelines for potassium say an intake of more than 3.5 grams a day. That's about 2/3 of a teaspoon. But a recent study looked at global mean potassium intake and found it was just 2.25 a day, and only 35% of the global population even achieved this target. So none of the 52 countries that reported combined sodium and potassium met these World Health Organization targets. So we really have a long way to go here. And when we are treating people with hypertension, we really need to raise their potassium. So this was a study, the Salt Substitute and Stroke Study, involved 20,000, almost 21,000 participants for 5 years. And what they did was they had people switch regular salt for potassium-enriched salt, Morton Salt Substitute, New Salt, NU and NU NEW, both brands exist. These all contain potassium chloride. And over 5 years, what they saw in their group was a 14% decrease in the risk of stroke, a 13% decrease in the major cardiovascular deaths, and a 12% decrease of premature death. Now, let me just tell you to put this in proportion. There is no dose of statin that will give you a 13% decrease in cardiovascular events in 5 years. These are pushed on us very, very hard. This is a bombshell. And they didn't just say, oh, well, did they take this salt substitute? They actually measured the sodium and the potassium in the urine of the trial participants. And then they looked at who was compliant. They looked at the dose response changes. They double-checked their findings. And basically what they found was supplementary potassium accounted for between 60 and 88% of the blood pressure lowering effects recorded in the trial. So taking away salt helped some, but adding potassium made a much bigger difference. Let's talk about the DASH diet to lower hypertension, right? That diet is lots of fruits and vegetables, because guess what's in fruits and vegetables? You guessed it, potassium, and lots of it. Fruits like bananas, kiwis, and dates have the highest numbers. Leafy green vegetables, the one I always go to with my patients, because they legumes and leafy green vegetables have lots of fiber, which is good for your microbiome. They are relatively low calorie, and so they won't raise your weight, which is not good for your blood pressure. And they contain hordes of potassium, so they're just really good for you. Now, here's the key. When I say fruits and vegetables, the more processed it is, like if it's vegetables that have been chopped up and then re-extruded into a, you know, vegetable Cheeto effectively, a quote-unquote healthy fast snack food, the actual processing itself reduces drastically the amount of potassium in these products. And in order to add back flavor, it's often replaced by sodium, which is cheaper than potassium. So we really need to get on top of this. The number of people living with hypertension has doubled in the last 30 years. Now, a lot of that is the obesity. But some of that is probably the ultra-processed foods that have just permeated the environment. I have had the good fortune in my life to travel serially to a number of countries, particularly in Southeast Asia, and compared the diets compared to my first visits, which would have been back in the early 90s, to the current diets have shifted drastically, and they have shifted in the direction of more processed foods. So switching to salt substitutes, that is a trivial thing to do. And you'll find a lot of doctors are afraid to recommend it because they have their patient on a diuretic that contains both the thiazide diuretic, which lowers potassium, and an aldosterone inhibiting drug, which raises potassium. And they're afraid of getting too high of a potassium. And it actually says, you know, proceed with caution if you're giving potassium supplements. But they're talking about very large doses of potassium that we give in pharmaceutical forms. So you can use salt substitute, and you can use a teaspoon of that a day, and you don't come close to 20 milliequivalents of potassium. And I have lots of experience mixing these quote-unquote aldosterone inhibitors with potassium, and you look at the levels, and the kidneys adjust, and you don't end up with really high levels. And what you do end up with is a substantial improvement in blood pressure. And one of the things that some of the drugs that we use for blood pressure, in this case I'm talking about chlorthalidone, which is a type of water pill or diuretic called a loop diuretic, it causes the body to lose electrolytes, both potassium and sodium are lost in that circumstance, but potassium even more so. And the problem with chlorthalidone is that it can cause diabetes. The loop diuretics are notorious for aggravating diabetes. And so what we want to do here is find a supplement pattern that's going to reduce the blood pressure and not, diuretics. I should have said that chlorthalidone is a thiazide diuretic. My mistake. Everything else I said is accurate. The main thing here is that if we're going to raise the blood sugar, how could we fix it? And the answer is yet another mineral, magnesium. So if you take a thiazide diuretic, you're going to reduce levels of potassium in the blood. You're going to raise blood sugar. So if you also give potassium, then you get back the potassium levels in the blood. And if you also give magnesium in the form of magnesium citrate, citrate is also found in fruits and vegetables and is probably good for you. You get a substantial lowering of the blood pressure and a substantial improvement in the glucose measurements. You don't get that unless you give all three. So what's the take home here? Drugs have consequences. Sometimes you need them. You can fight a lot of the consequences by just putting things back the way you found them. This came in from Bruce and Diane in Seaside, California. Hi, you're one of the few people we would trust to give us an answer. How much protein do we need? I am 73 and my wife is 70. A while ago, we joined a church called CrossFit. It's a friendly bunch. We fit in well. Both of us want to lose a couple of pounds. We've asked various people. One of our sons is vegan. He says we can get everything we need from plant-based protein. The other son tells us that we need to eat more meat. He tells me I need to consume 105 grams of protein a day. The coaches in the gym also tell us to eat more protein. So we've been eating more protein, and it seems to be working. We have lost a little weight. But that leaves us with the question, how much protein do we need? Thanks, Bruce and Diane. Bruce, it depends on your goals. If your goal is to maintain muscle, and you are over 75, 80, you need about a gram of protein per kilogram of body weight. So you take your body weight, you divide it by 2.2, and that's the number of grams you need to maintain muscle. If you want to build more muscle, you probably need to go up to 1.25, raise it a little more. And again, depending upon the grams of protein that you need, you're going to be raising your calories, but calories in carbs and protein are the same. It's way more complicated than calories when you're trying to lose weight. My recommendation is to use a plant-based protein powder. There are lots of them available. I typically recommend for people to use a variety of them, maybe soy, and then when you run out of soy, get hemp, and then when you run out of hemp, get pea protein, and so on. The idea, there's also rice protein, there's a bunch of different ones. The idea is that by varying these, you will avoid developing food sensitivity, and you will get more benefit and have less side effects. The main thing there is to find a high-quality product that's clean and doesn't have a lot of other garbage in it. You could eat, conceivably, theoretically, enough plants to get that much protein, but veganism is hard. And when you're 30, you can definitely be a vegan and spend the time and process the food and do it well and get your requirements of protein. That's because your digestive system is young. It's well perfused. I find that as my patients get older, if they are vegan and they are getting into their 70s, they tend to be having a hard time absorbing the plant protein. I think it's harder to break it down. And I always switch them to these powdered things, which I think are obviously pre-broken down. Sometimes I'll even put people things called hydrolyzed proteins, which have basically been subjected to an acid bath to make them even more absorbable. The point is, you can put it in your mouth, but is it going to get into your bloodstream? And that's true of calcium, that's true of protein, that's true of vitamin B12, as well as other vitamins, the fat-soluble vitamins. So nutrition doesn't end at the teeth. It actually, there's a whole system that has to absorb and use these compounds you put in your mouth. And if you don't successfully absorb them, there are plenty of bacteria downstream that will digest them. And there's plenty of room for it to go down into the sewer. So you need to monitor your protein mass as you lose weight and you're exercising. So you probably will do fine, but it's very important to keep that exercise up. And I think it's always better to not lose more than a pound a week, even in an aggressive weight loss plan, and hopefully you're losing much less. You do need to get tested. I don't know if they have a BIA scale at your gym, but this is something that will kind of give you a rough number for your percentage body fat and your percentage lean body mass. And the important thing there is that you've got to be hydrated exactly the same or more or less the same every time you do it. So if you do it say after you've had a liter of water over the last 2 hours, you're going to show up with a higher lean body mass than you actually have, and that lean body mass, which is sitting in your bladder and your bloodstream, is going to get peed out, and you fooled yourself. And the one thing you don't want to do is lose muscle. So exercise, adequate protein, and make sure you're absorbing it, and monitor that bioimpedance index. And you can get a BIA scale for a good one for about $100. And again, it's only accurate if the amount of water in your body is more or less the same when you test. But if you seem to be losing protein or losing lean body mass, that's something you need to address. And I'm saying that not necessarily to Bruce and Diane, but to everybody, because I think it's such a big deal. Here's an email from Thomas, and Thomas writes, finasteride long-term follow-up. I'm going to skip over his commentary there. I know you are a great proponent of intermittent fasting. I've started to do a 10 to 14 schedule, not eating anything after 7 p.m. and breakfast at 9 a.m. Would you comment on the recent headlines regarding intermittent fasting? And this is an article that was a poster session, I believe. So this is a research abstract digital file, but it isn't been published in a peer-reviewed journal. I need to emphasize that. It's also an epidemiology and prevention conference, and therefore it's the lowest bar of data. Epidemiology is fraught with problems with study ascertainment. And what I think of this study is I think it's probably, even if it gets published, I think it's supremely unimportant because these studies were really poor quality in terms of the fact that it was based on a 24-hour diet recall. What it showed, that the people who said they were doing that, who were eating time-limited, who they basically used a 4 to 12-hour window to call that intermittent fasting. They quote the fact that previous research has shown that time-restricted eating improves things like blood pressure, blood glucose, and cholesterol, but those are all surrogate markers. Then they looked at this is 20,000 adults. This is from the NHAME study, and they were in an 8-hour eating window, so 16 hours of not eating and 8 hours of eating. They were all 49, or the average age was 49. They were followed for somewhere between 8 and 17 years, and they were at least 20 years old when they enrolled. And they had two 24-hour dietary recall questionnaires within the first year of enrollment. Okay, so that's the data. Then let's go forward 8 to 17 years, and we're going to look at whether or not they had any adverse effect. And what they found in this study was a higher risk of cardiovascular death, and it's a suspiciously high increase, which is one of the reasons I'm doubting the study. It's a 91% increase, so that's almost a doubling. And this is based on 2 days of history, 8 to 17 years before the actual event occurs. So it's just not good enough, is the simple thing to say. It gets in the newsroom as a news flash, but it's just too flawed to believe. I'm looking here at the poster. And the one thing that does make sense about this study is an eating duration of greater than 16 hours a day was associated with a lower risk of cancer mortality in people with cancer. That I believe, because when you've got cancer, you're eating for two. And what you eat matters. But if you don't eat and you are fasting, that with the exception of people on chemotherapy, where there is definitely an established benefit to fasting, it does mean, among other things, that you're probably nearing the end of the road with your cancer, because the cancer does reduce your appetite at the same time that, not to mention the cancer therapies, but the cancer reduces your appetite just at a time when you really need to be eating more. So, yes, that's an observation. It's true, but what does it mean in terms of the benefit of time-limited eating? Nothing. It's just not useful. Okay, we've got a little more time, and so I'm going to take a moment and continue on the thread of drugs causing other diseases, because this really is a big problem in medicine. This one is about gabapentin and pregabalin. The reason I think it's super important to talk about this is it has gotten so hard to write for narcotics. You can't get the chain pharmacies to provide them. They say, oh, well, we don't have it in stock. I'm like, seriously, you don't have 10 milligram 325 hydrocodone in stock? Why not? It's crazy. And on top of that, the institutions that hired most of the primary care doctors and now control them discourage the use of narcotics. And we're in the middle of a massive backlash against narcotics because of some very bad actors, and I'm not denying that we have a problem, but our problem now is fentanyl, not prescription drugs. But we're behaving, we're conflating the two, which is a big mistake. And it's leading to just handfuls of gabapentin being given out for improper indications. Gabapentin calms nerves. It's an excellent agent for nerve pain, like the kind you might get from shingles or from a pinched nerve in your back. It really isn't very good for a broken leg or for post-surgical pain. That's a completely, that's inflammatory pain, and it either needs to have the pain sensation cut off at the brain, or it needs anti-inflammatories, or both. That would be nice. There's downsides to anti-inflammatories too, however. However, we're giving out all of this pregabalin and this gabapentin, same drug effectively. It's associated with a doubling of the risk for COPD exacerbations requiring hospitalization. So if you give gabapentin to a patient, if you have, let's say, moderate to severe COPD, and your doctor gives you gabapentin for your back pain because they don't want to give you anything else, even if it's not a pinched nerve, if it's arthritic back pain, if it doesn't matter. They're going to try to get by with giving you this drug because it's safer for them. It's maybe not safer for you. And this is an example of something that I have never seen before, the association with gabapentin and pregabalin with COPD exacerbations. But I have a number of patients who are on both drugs that I now know I'm going to need to, you know, be watching out for that and be looking for an alternative, because, you know, pain doesn't kill you, but COPD sure will. And a hospitalization is one of the most dangerous things you can do for someone with pulmonary disease, because all the cool germs hang out in the hospital, right? So drugs that make other things worse. We're on a roll here. A pilot study shows that a ketogenic diet improves severe mental illness and drastically reduces one of the big side effects of all of the drugs we use for schizophrenia, the antipsychotic medications. These drugs regulate the brain chemistry, but they cause insulin resistance and they cause obesity. And so researchers at Stanford Medicine recently published a pilot study using a ketogenic diet. They found not only did it help restore the metabolic health in these patients, but it improved their psychiatric conditions. We've long used ketogenic diet to treat schizophrenia, and it's also got a long track record for treating autism. But there wasn't a lot of information. There's some old stuff back in the 70s about using it for schizophrenia, but it never got any traction back then. However, it really works for psychiatric disease. It's reduced participants improved 31% on a psychiatric rating called the Clinical Global Impression Scale. And 3/4 of the people on the ketogenic diet showed, quote unquote, clinically meaningful improvement. They had greater life satisfaction, better sleep. They lost 10% of their body weight, 11% around their waists, and had lower blood pressure, body mass index, triglycerides, blood sugar levels, and insulin resistance. So this is a preliminary study. It didn't have a control group, all of the things that we look for, but it's certainly enough to boost the idea that in patients who are on antipsychotics, we should be considering and coaching a ketogenic diet. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.